Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Gail Harris, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Ah, the golden years of retirement. They're supposed to be full of time with the grandkids, cruises around the world, indulging in those hobbies you never had enough time for. But that was then. Retirement now isn't what it used to be. For one thing, more people are choosing not to retire at all, and many Americans can't afford to. The number of older Americans in the workforce is growing so much that businesses are slowly waking up to the new wave of silver-collar employees working well into their 60s, 70s, and beyond. Baby boomers, nearly 78 million of them, better health and increased longevity are all part of the picture, but so are economic insecurity and the need to shore up meager retirement savings. Whatever their reasons, more people are staying on the job and they are changing how we work. Tonight on Point, America's silver-collar workforce. We invite you to join the conversation. Do you want to be working in your 70s and 80s? Are you now? And if so, are you working because you want to or have to? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And a little later in the program, we'll also be talking about today's major Supreme Court decision on homeowner property rights and eminent domain. So stay with us for that. But first, joining me to talk about America's aging workforce is Peter Coy, economics editor and senior writer at Business Week magazine. His cover article in this week's issue is titled, Old, Smart, Productive. Surprise! The graying of the workforce is better news than you think. Welcome, Peter.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
And also with us from Hanover, New Hampshire is Jack Beatty, On Point News analyst. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Gail. Hello, Peter. Excuse me.
Certainly. Caught you in mid-cough, but that's quite all right. Peter, so, surprise. I saw this cover story as I was walking through an airport on Monday, and it's certainly a grabber. I mean, were you surprised by what you found when you began digging into this?
I really was, because the conventional wisdom, which I guess I shared, is that the aging of the American population was strictly bad news. Bad for Social Security, bad for Medicare. There'd be a lot of old people who would have to be supported by a shrinking share of the population that's really in the working age group. And how could there be anything good in this? But as I looked into it more, I realized that we've actually made a lot of progress on this front. You know, for most of the 20th century, as people's lifespans were increasing, their work spans were decreasing. They were retiring earlier and earlier. But something surprising happened around 1985. The retirement ages stopped getting younger and younger and started getting older and older. So we've had 20 years now of gradually creeping up retirement ages. So all the gloom and doom about a gigantic number of boomers sitting around by the pool or on the golf course while their Gen X is working to support them is not quite so gloomy anymore with that perspective.
But as you say, I mean, you mentioned Gen X. What's good for the boomers may not be so good for the next generation. They've probably been pawing the ground, many of them, waiting for the boomers to get out of the way. So are they going to offer the first line of resistance here?
Well, the reason that, of course, that's a concern, but the reason it's not as much of a concern as you might think is that, of course, that's a smaller generation than the giant boomer generation. And recently, employers have been worrying about labor force shortages. And the fact that boomers are working longer is actually good news because it means that they'll actually have enough people to do the jobs that need to be done.
So is what is happening now sort of the leading edge of a much larger phenomenon? And if so, what will that look like when it gets here full time?
That's exactly the point of the article, which you just said. It's the leading edge. So, I mean, my lead anecdote is a 92-year-old woman, Emma Schulman, social worker at New York University School of Medicine, who recruits Alzheimer's patients for a research clinic there. And, you know, she works close to 50 hours a week, and her boss says he'd have to hire two or three people whenever she decides to retire. I met her, and she is a dynamo. But I'm not arguing, of course, that most people are ever going to work into their 90s or even into their 80s. But they're role models. You know, Kurt Kerkorian and the investor, Alan Greenspan, the Federal Reserve Chairman, people like that are working well past the age when it's been assumed you're no longer able to contribute to the economy. So the boomers are going to be certainly able to work. And it's not just that they're able to work. Our argument is that many of them are going to want to work. They're going to be physically healthier than previous generations at any given age, mentally sharper, because improvements in healthcare tend to improve mental acuity as well, and they're going to be better educated. And people who are more highly educated traditionally tend to work a little longer because they tend to have the more interesting kind of jobs that you want to keep doing. So we're looking at this overall as a positive phenomenon, not that people so much have to work as that they will want to work and they'll be rewarded for it.
I want to turn to Sarah Ricks now, who's joining us from Washington. She is a senior policy advisor in the Public Policy Institute at AARP. Sarah, welcome to you.
Thank you.
Do you find that there are jobs now, and do you think there will be jobs in 10 years for all the people who would like to remain employed?
Well, I'd like to think that there will be, but I'm not so certain. And I do want to say that I think everything that Peter has said in his article is correct about a sizable proportion of the older population and the boomer population. But it's also incorrect about a sizable proportion. We're talking about, when we're talking about the boomers, a large and very heterogeneous group of individuals. And while many of them are healthier, better educated, and more capable of continuing to work longer than older persons of the current and previous generations, many of them do face health and disability problems. A recent report from the Congressional Budget Office, for example, found that 4 million boomers have already left the labor force. And that was as of last year, when the oldest was only 57. And the most common reason that for leaving the labor force was disability. So these are problems that many older people face and continue to face. Many also face job loss and great difficulty finding work. Age discrimination remains a problem for many older workers. There's a lack of appealing work options. And I think this is critical, too. While the older individuals in the Newsweek or the Businessweek article, had good jobs, and they were in stimulating positions, probably had a lot of autonomy. Many of them were working for themselves. They were doctors and lawyers. We've got to think about the large number of older workers who are in lousy jobs or doing the types of things that perhaps they don't want to or can't continue doing much later in life.
Well, let me put the question directly then. What's the AARP doing about it?
The AARP is doing a great deal to encourage employers to promote employment opportunities for older workers, to offer the types of work options that older workers say they want, more and better part-time work, for example. And not all older workers want part-time work. Many want to continue in their full-time positions. Many would like to phase into retirement in the jobs that they have. Others would like to move into new careers, to go into self-employment. And we have a number of projects and programs underway to assist older workers in their efforts to remain employed or to find employment.
When senior job fairs are held around the country, and I guess there have been a few of them, what happens there? I mean, are people lined up around the block? Because there really are a lot of people who are either underemployed or looking for something better or simply getting bored at home, perhaps wanting to return to the workforce.
There are all those reasons, but at job fairs, it's often individuals who really do need to work. However, the Business Week article was correct. Many older workers want to remain in the labor force because they like what they're doing. They want to remain active. They want to continue making a contribution. They're bored, or they feel they will be bored when they stay at home. They think find work is fun. It's a source of social interaction. So there will be many people who remain at work or try to remain at work because that's what they want to do, just as there will be many who need to remain at work because they don't have the resources to retire as early as they would like.
And what's the public policy piece here? I mean, what could government do to make working more attractive so that more people would continue paying into Social Security, for example, than collecting it?
Well, one thing would be, I guess, better enforcement, monitoring and enforcement of the Age Discrimination in Employment Act. Because once out of a job, it is extremely difficult for older workers, even today, to find employment. That may improve, and I think the Business Week article highlights the main reason, and that will be, or is likely to be, labor shortages that many employers are going to face in the future. There are efforts that could be undertaken to make phased retirement more of an option for employers to offer their workers. There are a number of legal impediments to formal phased retirement programs, and if those were eliminated, then it might be easier for older workers to obtain the gradual transition into retirement that so many say they are looking for. Prorated benefits for part-time work would enhance increase the attractiveness of part-time work for older workers.
Jack Beatty?
Well, you know, we joked about this, Gail. The motto of our generation could be, hell no, we won't go. We're going to hang on and make it tougher. You know, this silver collar phenomenon, I'm sure it's going on, one, I think, negative side to it is that it's almost certain to strengthen arguments to raise the retirement age or to accelerate the increase in that. And I think that would work great cruelty on the people who do the work of this world.
I agree.
We're going to continue our discussion in just a moment after a quick break. We're talking tonight about the growing ranks of America's older workers. Is the era of early retirement over? What does it look like at your workplace? Are baby boomers the generation that's redefining how and why we work and for how long? Or are they just the ones who won't let go? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Gail Harrison for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Gail Harrison for Tom Ashbrook, and we're talking this hour about silver-collar America, the burgeoning numbers of older Americans at work. You can join the conversation. Seniors, are you staying at work, going back to work because you want to or because you have to? Younger workers, are your silver-collared colleagues a deep well of experience, or are they taking and keeping the jobs you want? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And we're joined tonight by Peter Coy, economics editor at Business Week magazine and author of this week's cover article, Old, Smart, Productive. And with us also is Sarah Rick, senior policy advisor at AARP, and our own Jack Beatty. And Jack, I want to just ask you to finish the thought there before we took a break. Are you one of those who's saying, no, I won't go, thank you very much?
Yes, I am, and I hope to die right here at this microphone. Actually, not tonight, not for a while.
Yes, make it a long time from now,
that's
please.
That's right. No, I mean, sure, I want to hang around, but look what I'm doing. I'm sitting down here. I'm talking on the radio. You know, I get a certain amount of deference. People listen to what I say here. A lot of reason to keep working, but that's not true of many, many, many people who are far more important to keeping the society and the economy going than I am. And those are the people I'm worried about, who I'm afraid will get easily lumped in with this idea that, well, look, these boomers are reinventing themselves. They're having a great retirement and things are going along. But, you know, if we know one thing, we know that longevity and income are related. And it's a pity, but that's the way it is. So you could imagine a situation in this country where, you know, working people would go right up to age 70, and then at age age 71, they would die, I mean, from all their years of work. And of course, that would take care of the Social Security problem, but it wouldn't really be a great victory, it seems to me, for our society.
Peter Coy, I want to hear from you on that as well. You know, fewer jobs now are as physically demanding, perhaps, as they used to be. Is that part of what's changed here to make it possible for people to keep on going?
Yeah, the statistics from the Labor Department show that according to people's own evaluation of their jobs, fewer and fewer require heavy physical effort. At the same time, the disability rate has been falling, and people actually, and this is across the spectrum of jobs, not just white-collar jobs, that there are fewer jobs in the economy that demand heavy lifting, for example. I want to go back to what Jack said, because he's touching on an extremely important point and a very controversial one, which is, you know, a lot of the points I make in my article are all about the positive reasons, making it possible for people who want to work longer to work longer, and I think Sarah Rick said that as well. We're pretty much all in agreement on that. Where it gets stickier is on the question of whether the retirement age for Social Security ought to be raised. And my article concludes that it probably should, although I put in a big caveat on that, which is that in order to take care of the kind of people that we're worried about, the ones who really do have difficult jobs that are just become overwhelming as they get older, or people who are in failing health, make sure to liberalize the rules for qualification for disability. So those people who truly can't work anymore would qualify for disability benefits under Social Security. 8 million people, families, already get those benefits, so it's a well-established program. And if that could be done, it would take care of the truly disadvantaged. At the same time, it would make it more possible to raise the Social Security retirement age for those of us who are perfectly healthy, in line with the increase in longevity and health at older ages.
Sarah Rick,
that would improve the financing of Social Security.
I know you have to go in a moment, but before you do, perhaps you'd speak to Peter's point and also to whether you overall think this is a positive trend or whether it does give you pause.
Well, I think whatever fosters a voluntary longer work life is a positive development. And as Peter said, I think we're all in agreement on that. Our position is that the age of eligibility for Social Security benefits should not be raised until we've had an opportunity to assess the impact of the current increase. But whatever is done, I think we need to ensure that there are more and better training and retraining opportunities across the life cycle so that people in all types of jobs have greater opportunities to prolong their work lives if that is what they are interested in doing.
Sarah Ricks, I know you need to go. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for inviting me.
Sarah is Senior Policy Advisor at the Public Policy Institute at AARP. I want to bring Victor Marshall into the conversation now. He is professor of sociology at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. He is also director of UNC's Institute on Aging and leader of the U.S. team on the International Program on Workforce Aging in the New Economy. Victor, welcome to you.
Thank you, and thanks for inviting me, Gail.
Well, let me ask you the same thing I just put to Sarah. Do you think this is positive overall, or does it hold some concerns for you?
It is positive, but not overall. It does. I guess I'm very much like Sarah on this, which I've been familiar with her work for a long time. In fact, maybe that's why. Overall, I think it's positive because I think that work is positive for very many people. And however, as she pointed out, there really are some people that Peter's really excellent article just, you know, doesn't really pay attention to. There are a lot of people who, in fact, even if we do all sorts of things to make work more attractive or to induce people or practically compel people to work longer, some people just are not going to be able to do so. One national survey finds that 40% of retirees said that they actually retired earlier than they had intended. So it's one thing, people may have intentions to work longer, but a lot of people can't. And as Sarah pointed out, health is one of those reasons. There's a lot of other reasons. One that hasn't been mentioned so far, for example, is providing elder care. A lot of people, women more than men, but also some men, actually leave work in order to provide care to either their parents or spouse who need it in later life as well. So there's lots of involuntary reasons why people, some people, are not going to be able to continue working.
I want to hear from one of our listeners now from Franklin, Massachusetts. Vicki's on the line. Hello, welcome.
Hi. Hello there.
Yes, go ahead.
Yes. It was just a comment that I wanted to make. I'm the director of a mental health clinic in Franklin, Massachusetts, and I'm in a position to hire people. And in the past few years, I have hired one-third of our staff is over 65 years old. And I would say these are the best, some of the best therapists that we have in terms of their energy and hard work and long hours. And one staff is in late 70s and is a full-time person. And is there strictly for the love of the work. There are no benefits involved even, which is a shame to say because it's a fee-for-service work model. But these clinicians bring so much to the job because of their age, because of their life experience. So I consider it an asset to me, to the clinic, you know.
Well, Vicki, let me ask you, one of the concerns that I've read about is that if you hire someone in their 30s and they don't work out, no problem letting them go, but someone who is older could claim age discrimination. Is that something that would...
I suppose, but because one-third of the staff is in their 60s and 70s, I think that would mitigate against the statement that we're discriminating, just because we do hire all the time in that age bracket. So it would be, if someone didn't work out, it would be for very specific reasons around tasks.
Vicki, thank you so much for the call. Victor, I'm interested in your response to that notion and also to the question of whether this is an age group that is likely to be comfortable answering to bosses who, you know, might be in their 30s or 40s.
Right. Okay. Actually, I thought it's a great example. There's an organization now called Civic Ventures, and they are very involved with actually making it promoting work by older people, often not for pay even, but sometimes for pay as well. But what they find is an awful lot of people in their 50s and early 60s, they want to continue working, but they want to redirect their work to to the public sector or something that's going to be helpful as a contribution to the common good, I guess you could say. It's a very interesting organization, Civic Ventures. I think a lot of people do have that that impulse, after they maybe made it, get some security and are able to go on and do that. There is an issue. There is some data on this, not a lot of data, but one of the problems that does arise in the workplace is that older workers often resent being supervised by younger managers. This often happens because younger people are brought in. They're considered to be, because of the age stereotypes that are involved, they're considered to be, let's say, more technically savvy and so forth, and actually are often given more more opportunities for promotion even. And so, and some older workers are kind of viewed as almost redundant, although they're still working. There's a recent study in Australia and England that shows this resentment happens in both countries in some workplaces. On the other hand, there's a lot of positive relationships between younger and older workers as well in workplaces.
Well, we have someone very special on the line now from Tillamook, Oregon. Her name is Mildred Davey. She is the 93-year-old station manager at radio station KMBD. That's a station, by the way, that was named after her in honor of her 40-plus years of service on the air. She's also the host of a daily program called It's a Woman's World, and you can hear it live every morning at 9:30 a.m. Pacific on KTIL and KMBD in Tillamook. Mildred, welcome to you.
Good afternoon. I have a terrible noise in my phone
Can you speak a little louder?
I'll do my best. I want to ask about how your career began. I understand you were in your 50s. You had raised a family. What has kept you going all this time?
Well, I think perhaps I just was lucky to be born with good genes, and I've had a wonderful life. I had a great husband, one wonderful child, who is now a teacher over in Croatia, coming home in about a month, and I'll be so happy when he gets here. So I have, I've really been surrounded by love and by friends and doing something that I simply, every day is a new challenge, and I love it.
Has anyone dared suggest along the way that you retire, and what would you tell them if they had?
Well, I'll tell you, it's suggested every day, believe me. Why do you insist upon getting up at 6:30 in the morning and going to the station a little later? And I say, because I want to. It's not the things you do that you want to do that wear you out. It's the things you don't want to do and you have to do. So I've been a very, very fortunate woman, and I know it.
And I would imagine that you have probably been a mentor to a number of other women over the years.
Well, I haven't led them down the wrong path, I don't think. I worked for many, many years in downtown Tillamook, which is a small town. And when my husband came home from the war, we'd been married 10 years, I said, that's it, I'm going to have a baby. And so I quit work and had that baby. And I stayed home, and I did everything. Red Cross, Eastern Star, Monday Musicals. I collected money for everything in this town. And when Dan was, my son was 13, John was employed as a controller at the Creamery Association, had a good job. And I had been approached many times to come to work for different, even political jobs, heavens forbid. And I asked them what they thought about me going to the radio station. I'd been approached by the manager, and they said, well, go ahead. We go early in the morning, and we don't get home until later in the evening. And so I went out to try and help out a little bit. The gentleman that owned it was a wonderful man. And I, of course, became interested up to my eyes, and I've been there all these years and have done programming and managing and public relations and just the whole bit. And I have this program that I've had. I'm in my 43rd year. I'll soon finish and be 44 years. Every weekday morning. Wouldn't you think they'd be so sick of me now they wouldn't even listen?
Well, clearly not, Mildred, and we've certainly enjoyed listening to you. Thanks so much for being with us.
It was my pleasure.
Mildred Davey, age 93, station manager at KMBD. Jack Beatty, what do you make of that?
What an inspiration. I mean, autonomy and self-direction and the desire for mastery and doing what you want to do rather than what... I mean, as she says, she is a very fortunate person to be able to work so long, but also to be able to have that orientation toward her work, where her work is a... You know, she gets up in the morning and she just can't wait to get in there and talk to the people on the radio. That's great. And if all work were like that, it would be paradise. Unfortunately, in the 20th century, most work went just the other way in fractionating tasks and making people narrower rather than bigger. And that's a topic for another day.
Peter Coy, did you find people who found this, all the possibilities in their late 50s or 60s and beyond, that the world was open to them in a new way? Maybe they weren't continuing to do what they always had, but now was a chance to do what they'd always wanted to.
The surveys find that boomers don't like the word retirement. It just conveys a whole different image to them than it did to an earlier generation. Earlier generation really saw we're going to finally get a chance to kick back and relax. Many boomers, I won't say all, want to stay active, and maybe not in paying work, it's true, but maybe volunteer work, or maybe maybe doing one or two small paying jobs in combination with travel and fun. It's not the idea of just one day turning out the lights and walking out the door and never coming back just really isn't appealing to the baby boom generation. And I think the fact that it's not is good news for the economy.
Well, and Victor Marshall, you know, you read about younger workers who want more flexible hours when their children are young, older workers who want more flexible hours for different reasons. I wonder if this is a place where the generations might find common ground and perhaps even force change that wouldn't happen otherwise.
That's a great point, actually. In the research that we've been doing, flexibility in the information technology sector, we're finding younger workers are flexible, and they're willing to work all night, you know, and that's one of the things that some employers like about them. But then they get a little older, and all of a sudden they want more job flexibility, partly because they have family concerns. They want a little more control over their life. I think we hear a lot about phased retirement, and that's a major vehicle for flexibility in the later years, but there are a lot of other ways to achieve flexibility as well, and it's really the coming thing. As Sarah pointed out, there's a lot that has to be done to de-bureaucratize the work process and the work retirement process to make it easier for people to phase into retirement without, you know, having economic penalties over their pensions and so forth.
All right, we're going to continue our discussion in just a moment. We're talking about the graying of America's workforce, and you can join us by calling 1-800-423-8255. I'm Gail Harrison for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Gail Harrison for Tom Ashbrook, and we're talking tonight about the graying workforce, baby boomers turning their backs on retirement and older Americans remaining on the job. So are you heartened or dispirited by the thought of working into your 70s or 80s? Should we be ticking up the retirement age or making room for younger workers? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And we're talking this hour with Peter Coy, economics editor at Business Week magazine, with Victor Marshall, director of the Institute on Aging at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. And we have a lot of listeners who want to get in on this as well. So let's go first to Cambridge, Massachusetts. Dankner is on the line. Hello and welcome.
Hi, how you doing?
Good, thanks. What did you want to add here?
Well, I think your people seem to have ignored some of the basic issues that are going around. Basically, you've ignored health care and the pension problems. Being for myself, I'm going to work until I die, because if I stop working, I have no way of paying my bills. Medicare is probably going to go belly up. That's not being even dealt with. And then paying for my bills. It's basically all I almost fail with my insurance. With my copay, I'm probably paying $200 a month.
So clearly you're not one of those who's working because you want to. Victor Marshall, any thoughts for Dankner?
I'm glad that Dankner actually said that, because it was on my list of things I wanted to say. You know, a lot of people are working because they just have to. We studied garment workers in Montreal, and they had Medicare coming up, so they were looking for ways to get out of work early. But we studied garment workers in New York City, and Medicare is much less comprehensive in the United States than it is in Canada, and it doesn't cover you before the age of 65. So they were determined to stay the course to 65 because they wanted that health care. People work, I think, because of a lack of medical insurance, because of insecurities about Medicare here. I think the rise in health care costs is probably, in the United States, is probably a very large reason why there has been that uptick in labor force participation rates. You know, people are looking to the future, and they're seeing, they're afraid. They really are worried about future health care costs and how they're going to meet them. And then, of course, there's a lot of insecurities about Social Security as well, which gives people pause. So I think Dankner really was right on the money with his comments.
And Peter Coy, clearly the tone of your article was celebratory, but will you be revisiting this part of the topic?
Oh, yeah. Well, we've visited it many times. Clearly, there are a lot of problems with soaring health care costs that are just just killing people. And, you know, there's no one silver bullet that solves all problems. I would like to point out that according to the Federal Reserve, which does a survey of cross-section of the population, the average net worth of families headed by 55 to 64-year-olds actually went up 74%. That's after inflation, between 1992 and 2001. And remember, 2001 was after the stock market had crashed, so it's not including a lot of bubble and stock prices there. So this is, of course, an average number. A lot of people have not done nearly that well, but I just throw the number out there to make the point that the increase in the retirement age cannot be explained entirely by a whole generation getting wiped out and having to work because of financial need. If anything, they had less need than they had a decade earlier when they were working fewer years.
In general. To Mike now, he's on the line from Nashville, Tennessee. Hello, Mike.
Hi, how are you doing this evening? I have enjoyed the topic this evening, and I guess I just have a request from my generation, who is right behind the group that you're talking about. I'm 40 years old, and I represent a group that's kind of caught in a gap between a very defined generation and the one that's right behind me. It's, please, just retire.
Get out of your way, huh?
Move to the promised land, will you? I guess I have heard so much conversation about what's in it for me, and I'm worried about, and all this discussion about the boomer generation, and the prospect that I have ahead looking for me is being in the workforce for 40 plus years, and everything that's going to be defined, and for some part already defined in my life, has already been laid out before me. I am looking at the prospect of, by the time I retire at whatever age, is probably determined by the boomers, will have no Social Security, no Medicare, because all of that is going to be consumed by the generation before me, and my generation is going to have absolutely no participation in that debate at all.
Mike, thank you so much for the call. Victor, I wonder if you could give him a quick response.
Well, I think give him some hope. Maybe it should become better in one sense. At least I think the boomers are already starting to retire out of the workforce. That's the large generation. The generation that follows it is smaller. There's less competition for employment. There are concerns about for the future about how we are going to fulfill labor force needs with the smaller entry cohorts to the labor force. So as these people finally move out, they may be on pensions, but they're also vacating jobs, and we're going to need to find younger people to fill them. So I'm counting him at 40 as young.
Right. Jack Beattie, I want to give you the last word here. Do you think the government needs to be more proactive on this, or is this more or less going to sort itself out on its own?
I mean, I think that the market is going to have a much larger part to play in it. But, you know, the gentleman that called from Cambridge reminded us of something historical, really. Advocates of slavery used to contrast the paternalism of slavery to the situation in the North, where workers were literally thrown out to die once they had finished working. And this gentleman said, "I can't. If I stop working, I will die." That's where we've come. And he has no bargaining power on his job with that desperation driving him. His dignity is limited because he's got to suffer all kinds of offenses, I'm sure, in order to live. That's not a good place for a country to be, I don't think.
Jack Beattie, thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
Peter Coy, economics editor, senior writer at Business Week magazine, thanks so much.
Thanks a lot.
And Victor Marshall, professor of sociology and director of the Institute on Aging at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Appreciate your being here.
Thank you. I enjoyed it.
You can continue the conversation online. Go to onpointradio.org and click on forums. In a moment, the Supreme Court makes a major ruling on eminent domain. This is On Point. The Supreme Court ruled today that local governments have the right to seize homes and businesses and turn them over to private developers. The 5-4 court decision is a major blow to the New London, Connecticut homeowners who brought the case. Suzette Kilo and other homeowners in a working-class area of New London filed suit after city officials unveiled plans to demolish their houses. According to local officials, the land would be used for an office building, riverfront hotel, and other commercial interests, an investment they claim will revitalize the area and benefit all residents of New London. Well, the case has provoked strong reactions from those involved, including the dissenting justices. Joining us with the reaction from Connecticut is Lynn Tui, court reporter for the Hartford Courant. She has been following the case. Lynn, welcome, and tell us what kind of reaction you've been getting in New London tonight.
The reaction is extremely strong and emotional, Gail. It's these homeowners, some have been there only a decade, as lead plaintiff Suzette Kilo has. The Derry family goes back more than a century in the cluster of homes that they own on this Fort Trumbull Peninsula. And they are saying this is not the last word. Suzette Kilo says, you are going to have to drag me kicking and screaming out of my house. They're not going without a fight, and yet legally this is probably the death knell to their quest to stay in their homes.
Is this being perceived there as a class issue, rich interests versus poor people?
Some people have twisted it that way. I'm not sure that it's so much a class issue, although the people that probably have most to fear from this decision are, you know, the poor and the working class, middle class. In the past, the Supreme Court has, in past cases, the Supreme Court has typically looked at situations where blight was a precursor to using eminent domain, taking down the buildings, and then ultimately some of the property may have wound up in private developments. But what they were trying to do was cure blight, or in the case of a Hawaii challenge, they were looking at concentrated land ownership and said it was all right to take that land by eminent domain because it was for the ultimate social good. In this case, we don't have blight. We have middle-class people in modest but very well-kept homes, very attractive homes, some that they've renovated from top to bottom, and they're being told, I'm sorry, but private development needs to happen to improve the tax base of the city, and you're going to have to leave.
And how many people are we talking about here?
We are talking about 7 families who own a total of 15 properties. And already the New London Development Corporation, since it began the condemnations in the year 2000, has obtained and raised about 100 properties where they negotiated sales with the owners. But these particular owners have dug in and said, you can't do this to me, it's unconstitutional. Mm-hmm. The Supreme Court has ruled otherwise.
Lynn Tui, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Gail.
Lynn Tui is court reporter for the Hartford Courant. She spoke with us from Hartford, Connecticut. And for more now on the legal aspects of this case and especially what it means for property rights across America, we turn to Jeremy Paul. He is a professor of constitutional and property law at the University of Connecticut Law School, and he's joining us from West Hartford, Connecticut. Welcome, Jeremy.
Thank you very much.
Now, I understand you heard the arguments in this case firsthand. What do you think about the ruling? Are you surprised?
I was not surprised. Based on what I heard in the argument, I expected that the government would win. I was actually more surprised the vote was as close as it was because Justice O'Connor, during the argument, seemed much more sympathetic to New London's case than her opinion turned out to be.
Well, in fact, she referred to the homeowners as victims and said, quote, the government now has license to transfer property from those with fewer resources to those with more. It kind of goes against the whole notion of a person's home being his castle, doesn't it?
Well, the resources which are transferred, of course, are only transferred after money is paid to the homeowner. But certainly these individual homeowners are being asked to bear some cost so that the greater good for the city of New London through its revitalization plan can take place.
What?
You know, as far as the home is the castle, sometimes yes, sometimes no.
Why do you think this case has gotten so much attention, and why do you think the vote provided such a bitter division between the justices?
I think it's gotten a lot of attention because it reflects many of the basic divisions in the society. It's actually an unusual constellation of forces in that the law firm that brought the suit on behalf of the homeowners generally, I think, would describe itself as a libertarian public interest law group. Yet at the same time, groups like the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, the NAACP, and the AARP both sided with the homeowners, whereas many more traditional progressive groups tend to side with government and with the city. So it sort of crossed unusual lines. And, of course, you're always going to get a lot of attention when you have small middle-class homeowners who are being displaced, seemingly to benefit people who are better off. Although, of course, the hope is that the people who work in the various office parks, et cetera, will not all be rich and that they will be benefited as well. But it's not surprising that it caused divisions. You know, we have the same divisions in our society in so many ways now. I think that, it would be very nice if people would work towards sort of more middle ground solutions. You know, I think what I would have liked to see was some outcome in which maybe the development plan would go forward, but the homeowners would have gotten more money than simply the straightforward market value that they're going to get now.
Well, and in fact, usually when we think of eminent domain, it's something like, local government taking homes for highways or parks or other public use projects, or a revitalization of an extremely blighted area. As we just heard from Len Tui, this was not a blighted area, and it's going to private interests.
No question that this is not traditionally what people think of when they think of eminent domain. But of course, for cities to be able to do the kind of things you mentioned, build schools, build roads, build parks, they need revenues. And one of the crises that we're facing as a society is that government revenues, particularly in urban areas, are falling well short of the needs of the population. One of the things that they're hoping to accomplish as a result of things like this is to build a jobs base, build a tax base, et cetera.
Are you aware of any similar cases elsewhere?
Oh, there are many cases like this. I mean, I think the lawyers who represented the homeowners this case represent homeowners in many different jurisdictions, New Jersey, Arizona, there was a case in Michigan, and one of the things that's important for all the listeners to understand is that this case was a federal case based on the United States Constitution, but one of the things the majority went out of their way to point out is that state constitutions are different, and state courts are free to interpret their constitutions differently, so you're still going to have many more opportunities for different judges to look at different sets of facts and perhaps reach different outcomes.
But clearly it would have some impact, is that fair to say, on other small towns across the country?
There's no question this case will be a trendsetter in terms of having an impact. But, as you can see from the result, this is a 5-4 vote. And among the five, one of the justices, Justice Kennedy, made very clear in his concurring opinion that although he was going to vote for this, he wasn't too happy about it, and that he would like to think of situations where the court would look more closely at what's going on. So in terms of being a signal to state courts all around the country, it's a very mixed signal.
Jeremy Paul, we have to leave it there for now. Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you very much.
Jeremy Paul teaches constitutional and property law at the University of Connecticut School of Law. I'm Gail Harrison for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.